This is When Science Speaks, a new web series profiling innovative and interesting people working in science and technical fields, from academia to industry to the nonprofit world. We explore how to be a powerhouse advocate for science and your research, how to advance your career in meaningful ways that make you happy, and how to push back on the ongoing assault on science and other related issues of interest happening in the world.
Well, hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning into When Science Speaks. Today's episode is brought to you by Bayer Strategic Consulting in Washington, D.C., which uses true-to-life training and insider relationship-building strategies to help natural and social scientists craft and communicate effectively to policymakers, private funders, potential employers, and the public. We are so fortunate to have Wendy Noss on the show today. Wendy is the Executive Director of the Consortium of Social Science Associations, and that's a post that she's held since 2014. In her role, Wendy serves as the lead advocate for federal funding and policy that positively impact social and behavioral science research across the federal government. Prior to leading the organization, Wendy spent a decade lobbying for the federal research and policy interests of scientific societies and U.S. universities. Over her career, she's worked to shape legislation, programs, and regulations important to the research community, and she's advocated for increased research funding across federal agencies. She is a native of Buffalo, New York, and holds a BA in political science and urban studies from Canisius College, graduating magna cum laude from the All College Honors Program. Welcome to the show, Wendy.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Absolutely. You know, you're a really seasoned policy advocate with significant advocacy experience at all levels of government. And, you know, for listeners who aren't familiar with even what a lobbyist does, so to speak, and you know, we can get into sort of the advocacy or the advocate versus lobbyist distinction. But what a lobbyist does, can you describe the main activities that you're focused on these days?
Yeah, absolutely. Lobbying has really changed a lot in the last 15 years or so with earmarks going away. And frankly, I don't think they're coming back. And so the advocacy in the lobbying community has really had to adjust. Thankfully, there are organizations around town, including in the science advocacy space, that didn't rely on earmarking and traditional lobbying and instead have really focused on engaging with policymakers and congressional staff in more of a relationship building way. So for COSA, we really have three aspects to our lobbying and advocacy activities. The first being direct lobbying, and that is me and my staff who are registered lobbyists, and we're on the ground every day. Should something happen that needs quick attention, we can go in and address it. The second piece being membership engagement. Our members are scientific societies and research universities that care about the behavioral and social sciences, and so equipping them with the tools, resources, and messages that they need to be effective advocates. And then our third leg, which is a newer area for us, is public engagement. And this is really making sure the public understands and appreciates social and behavioral science research. What we find is that once we explain what our sciences are and what they're capable of, it's hard for anyone, any member of the public, whether a policymaker or someone in your family, it's hard for them to argue against support for it. So in terms of our activities, we focus on funding policy primarily, but also to make sure that laws and regulations positively impact science and social science as opposed to hindering the sciences that we do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That is really, really interesting. You know, do you see a role for PhDs and postdocs in the natural and social sciences who are interested in this type of work?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, just last week, we hosted our fifth annual Social Science Advocacy Day, and we had a record number of social scientists come to town from across the country. We had about 75 advocates, and they came from across the disciplines, and we trained them and we took them to the Hill. And I would say all of them came into the experience thinking, I don't know why I'm here. What does my voice matter? But as they quickly learned, and the feedback is coming in from their experiences, their views are so much more valued on the Hill than a typical lobbyist for two reasons. One, they have expertise in a certain area, and so they're a trusted, credible resource to policymakers. But two, they're also a constituent and a voter. So they have two things working in their favor. And I think many think that researchers, scientists can't be passionate and do science. And that's really not true, because you're a person, a citizen first, and a scientist second. And you should bring both of those to bear.
You know, we're going to put information about how to get in touch with COSA and how to learn more about these things. But if I'm listening right now and I'm interested in getting involved, as you've described, you know, how would you suggest that PhDs, grad students, and postdocs, for example, learn more or gain skills and experience that would really position them for, you know, for a job or for, you know, for activity, as you've described, you know, as part of a Hill Day or maybe even as part of their, you know, their profession?
Yeah, the easiest way to get involved is to just start doing something, and that could happen at a variety of levels. My first piece of advice would be to get active in your professional society or association. Chances are they have a government affairs committee or an advocacy committee, or there's someone on the board of directors who's responsible for advocacy activities. And I can assure you they're always starved for volunteers to engage in their activities or to serve on these committees. And so I would suggest first looking there. There are so many free resources out there, including on the COSA website, whether your organization is a member or not, on how to do this. And the options for what you can do to engage are endless, from coming to Washington, but even more options of what you can do from home. And so I would start with your own circle and figure out what's available to you for free. If you're in a university, go to your government relations office. They would probably love to hear from you and know that you have stories that they can use when they communicate with the Hill, and even take you to the Hill with them.
Just a great piece of advice is to check in with your government relations department. I don't think people, you know, would typically think to do that. So thanks so much for highlighting that. You know, another thing that you mentioned too, Wendy, was earmarking and how advocacy has changed since you've been involved. I guess first off, could you just explain or describe what an earmark is, and then maybe just talk a little bit about, you know, this shift from, you know, an earmarked focus type of advocacy to something that's more along the lines of relationship building?
Absolutely. So earmarks, also known as pork barrel spending, they've been around since essentially the beginning of time. And it's a way for elected officials to show their constituents back home that they're bringing home the money, literally. So appropriations bills, which are bills that have to be enacted every year to fund the government and all of the programs that the government funds, and if they don't, we have a government shutdown, which we saw earlier this year. Within these appropriations bills, there used to be line items known as earmarks. And it would be $2 million for a bridge in Anchorage, Alaska, or $1 million for a new medical building at the University of Nebraska, for example. But several years ago, the practice of earmarks went away. And if you think about it, earmarks were a stick and a carrot for policymakers to truly find compromise and to get the bills passed on time. If that carrot is now gone, where is the incentive for Republicans and Democrats to work together to pass annual appropriations bills on time? There's really nothing in it for them personally or their state or constituent, other than it's good for the country to have a budget. So as a result, we've seen the environment that we're in right now, where funding and just shuts down because of partisan differences. And we've entered this new era where I don't think ever going to get back to earmarks. And so the relationships had started to become necessary in terms of lobbying, constituent-focused advocacy, building long-term relationships with committee and congressional staff. these are things that organizations have done, many organizations have done for a long time, but so many firms, lobbying firms, really their only business model was earmarking. And so with that going away, there's sort of this vacuum of trying to figure out how to affect change when there are no earmarks.
Absolutely. And you know, what are some of the biggest professional challenges that you see? I mean, this landscape shift, you know, as you pointed out, happened a few years ago, and you know, you've certainly adjusted, and the organization has adjusted to this. Are there other like sort of professional challenges out there that you're wrestling with, grappling with these days?
Well, I've been very fortunate. Even when I worked at the lobbying firm before coming to COSA, our model was not earmark focused. It really was sort of a more of an academic model where we dove into the issues themselves and we understood policy around climate change or social science or whatever it was. So that's not a professional challenge for me necessarily to figure out how to do this, but it is a challenge for so many in our community is to figure out, and my job now is to sort of hear the social science and the wonderful impacts that come from it and the potential there, and then communicate that to a policy audience in a way that affects change. That's a really tough skill, and I'm not a social scientist. I'm the translator. And so, you know, similarly, researchers and scientists don't go into a research field because they want to be a communicator or they want to talk to policymakers. So we each have to get out of our silos and figure out how we can sort of bring both sides together to articulate the value to a policy audience. And these days, with budgets the way they are, that's a necessity. It's not just, wouldn't it be nice if Congress understood social science? No, they have to understand it now, because if they don't fund social science research, that money is going to go somewhere else.
That is so true. You know, it's funny, I just finished a 4-webinar course that I teach on how to clearly communicate your science to any audience. And it's so true. I mean, the stakes are really high, as you point out, no more earmarks. And being that translator, I don't have a scientific background. My last science course was AP Bio senior year in high school, which I really loved, by the way. But I wasn't talented in that area. I had to work a lot harder than my peers, and I decided to focus elsewhere. But it's almost the reverse, as you're describing, for scientists, you know, who are really strong in their research and their work and the skills that go along with it, but now are being asked to communicate, to translate, to be really able to explain and distill what they do to people who can depend, you know, who can decide whether or not they're kind of like whether or not they're going to get, you know, funding. Moving forward. Absolutely. And, you know, is there thinking about this dynamic, you know, is there an example or a story that stands out in your mind, thinking back across all the experiences that you've had, kind of, you know, whether it's a big win that happened and how it, you know, how you made it happen, how it came together, something unexpected that happened, just to give people maybe an understanding of like, you know, what it's like to be in your position leading this organization?
Yeah, several points. You know, one being advocacy, successful advocacy actually takes a really long time, which is the polar opposite of the earmarking environment, where if you get that money, that's a win and you move on to the next project. But I would say the biggest success that stands out to me is still happening right now. So when I started at COSA in 2014, the social science funding landscape was really dire. Political science at the National Science Foundation was under attack and actually led to the defunding of that program for about a year, and also proposals to eliminate entire pots of funding for social science research. And it wasn't because there was necessarily a vacuum of advocates. There are so many wonderful advocacy groups for science and social science around town. But I think what was missing was sort of this centralizing force to really bring the community together and speak with one voice. And so since day one in 2014, my staff and I have worked really hard to build and nurture relationships, which typical, you know, lobbyists, earmarking type lobbyists, frankly, don't have the time or the bandwidth to do. because there are so many clients and so on, they have to deliver. And congressional staff and members of Congress change all the time. And so it is this sort of constant activity that you're constantly going through. But for us, it's paid off. So if you fast forward to today, now we have real champions in the Congress for our sciences, so that if these attacks come up, and they still do, not everyone in the Congress believes that taxpayers should be underwriting social science research. But when those attacks happen now, we have champions who will stop it before it becomes legislation or funding cuts or whatever. And so we've seen speeches on the House floor talking about social science. We even had a speech on the House floor talking about our advocates that came to Social Science Advocacy Day, which was exciting.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's really cool. And of course, you have, you know, you have scientists now who are serving as members, which, you know, is a result of a lot of work by so many folks too. You know, laying that out, that thank you, by the way, that really gives a good understanding of sort of what's going on right now. What do you consider the most important knowledge, skills, and abilities, say, for effective advocates?
Yeah, there are a couple. One, I would say, is passion. I think it's most impactful when you're on the Hill or you're writing an email to a policymaker or you're responding to an action alert that comes from your professional association and you're tailoring it in some way to tell your audience why you care about the research that you do. Why did you go into this field? It's not just, many think that if policymakers just understood the science better, they would automatically vote our way. And that's just not true. There's ideology, there's belief, there's all these other personal factors that go into that. And so we need to appeal to the personal side of a policymaker. And so why do you care? It's really infectious when you speak in those terms. And I would say the other piece, well, two pieces. One is follow through. Like I just mentioned, it takes a long time to nurture these relationships. And having one meeting once a year isn't going to do it. So finding natural ways to keep in touch, even if it's just sharing a news story from your university press office about a new scientific breakthrough, sharing that with your congressional delegation, or inviting them to come and meet with your class or visit your lab. And then the final skill or piece to this, and I think might be the most important, is learning how to be a storyteller. It's very easy to sort of go with what we're comfortable with. So I'm a storyteller because I'm a non-scientist, but scientists are not natural storytellers. And so working with science communicators, working with your government relation offices or your professional societies, as part of our training for our advocacy day, we spend an afternoon helping people figure out how to tell their story in a way that'll resonate. And those are not natural skills, and you have to work for it. But the payoff is tremendous when you're able to figure it out.
So true. So true. And, you know, you talked about your storytelling strength and interest. And, you know, what drew you to focus your career, you know, at least so far, on advocating generally and on advocating for science?
I've really enjoyed my career path so far. And I can take zero credit for ending up where I am. That's not entirely true, but I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I had an interest in history and politics and grew up in Buffalo, New York, where there wasn't a ton to do in presidential politics, which really what's interested me the most. And so I just, like so many people do, you intern here, you get the bug, and then you move down. And for me, my first job was in lobbying. But it was in scientific lobbying, and I felt like I was really doing a good thing. Lobbying is a bad word in some parts of the country. My family back home still doesn't quite understand what I do. When I talk about the type of things that I lobby for and the impacts that our science has on real challenges of global and national significance, they understand that. They understand the troubles in their city and in their family and illness and poverty. And so to be able to make some sort of connection between the science and those real issues, that has been really rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. So right. And, you know, what are, and you talked about this a little bit too, Wendy, I'm just wondering, you know, the most effective advocates in your view, you talked about having that passion and that follow through. Is there a particular example where you saw sort of all of these kind of amazing, powerful factors coming together, either in one particular situation or if there's one particular person, that a mentor or somebody that you think just really has all of these pieces like perfectly combined?
So I wish there was a really clear example like that because I think everyone in our community would just make a copy of it and follow that playbook. But I think what's most effective is actually incredibly simple. And we didn't realize it on our team until a couple of years ago. We started going to the Hill, and this started, I guess, 2 years ago with the new Congress then. And we were going in to meet with freshmen and people sitting in new leadership positions. And our strategy for our meetings was not to ask anything, but instead to ask what was of most importance to the policymaker. It has to be a science issue. It could be drinking water. We were at the height of the Ebola crisis. It could be criminal justice reform, cybersecurity. It didn't matter. But we thought, let's try meeting them where they are. And it was amazing to see the shift in a congressional staffer's body language because they're used to being asked things all day long. And now someone's coming in and asking how they can help them with no agenda. And as a result of that, our community now has really been seen as a resource, not just on social science issues, but on issues where you wouldn't think of social science. So just in the last year, we've been contacted by congressional offices because they're writing legislation on artificial intelligence and human rights and sexual harassment, and they want to be connected to people who can tell them what the social science says. That has been paying so many dividends for our community and our visibility, and I think it's only going to magnify the sort of value and the visibility of our sciences going forward. And it's so simple. Just ask them what they want. But after, 15 years, it finally occurred to me to do that. But it's been great.
And that's just wonderful. And you really know that you are successful when you start getting those calls. And that really feeds into this point you've been making about relationship building and not a one-way street. When you're being asked, by policymakers for the expertise of your members as an input, and perhaps there are going to be hearings on the legislation or things like that, or press conferences, and they would, want the participation of your members as part of that as well.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Is there any question that I did not ask you that I should have asked you?
Well, that's very interesting. I am often asked, what is the difference between lobbying and advocacy? And can I, as someone working in a university or a nonprofit organization, can I lobby without having to be a registered lobbyist? And so that is such an important question because I think definitions of advocacy and lobbying are really quite distinct, even though they've been conflated since the beginning of time. But it is everyone's right to advocate and to engage with your elected officials. And so I describe it as, the First Amendment to the Constitution provides for freedom of religion and speech and press and assembly. But we hear a lot less about the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. That basically means it was written into our founding documents that the people of the country can petition, can go and speak with their elected officials. Now, most people don't do that. And so as a result, over time, we have seen professional lobbyists filling this vacuum between the people and their government. And what we're trying to do is to get the people back involved in governing. And so organizations like COSA and so many others are created to ensure that our community's distinct voice is also heard. But we're not meant to be a replacement for the voices of individuals. So while advocacy and lobbying can sometimes mean the same thing, lobbying in sort of the DC terms is very specific. And there are rules around it that are spelled out in statute that I and my staff have to follow because we are professional lobbyists. But my sort of advice to those who are wondering about this is If you find yourself wondering if your activities make you a lobbyist, they most likely don't. You'll know if you're a lobbyist and you need to follow any lobbying rules.
Well, wonderful. Those will be the last words for the show. Wendy Noss, this was really illuminating. I know that the insights that you provided folks are going to be really, really helpful. Executive Director of the Consortium of Social Science Associations, COSA, this was just great. Thank you again so much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure, and thanks for all the work you do.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to click subscribe. Check us out on the web at whenscienceSpeaks.com, and we'll see you next time.